I don't want to stay married to Osman Musa, although I respect him and he has not mistreated me in any way. I understand what you're doing for me and how extraordinary this is, and I understand that my answer is final. The Bokor paused for a moment. He was clearly taken aback. He said, "May we ask you some questions?" And I agreed. He asked, "Has Osman Musa been violent?" And I said, "No. He has always been completely correct in every way." "Is he stingy?" "No, he has been very generous." "Do you know something about Osman that we don't know?" "No, I don't know him at all." "Is there someone else?" I said, "No." With every question, he was offering me a way to explain myself in a way that would justify my behavior and lessen the stigma on my honor and on my father's good name. But I was determined not to lie, not to claim that Osman Musa had hurt or cheated me in any way. It would not have been fair. I simply didn't want him. Finally, Abdullahi Musa Bokor asked, "So why are you doing this?" I paused for a moment, and then the words just came out of my mouth. "It's the will of the soul," I said. "The soul cannot be coerced." The language I used was grandiloquent. Not at all the language you would expect from a woman, let alone a 23-year-old. Abdullahi Musa Bokor stared at me and then he said, "I respect this answer. I believe all of us should respect it." He turned to Osman and said, "Do you accept it?" Osman said, "I have to." Then the Crown Prince told the gathering that Osman's acceptance should be seen as honorable and brave and should enhance his reputation for wisdom. He embraced Osman Musa and patted his back. All the men present did the same. I felt bad about what I had done to him. It wasn't this poor man's fault. I said, "I will pay you back one day, you know, for the air ticket and all the expense," because this had been bothering me. Osman Musa was deeply insulted. He said, "In addition to everything you have already done, this is really rubbing salt in the wound. According to the honor code, it was not required." But I had not meant to insult him. I said I was grateful. All the men stood up then, and one after another, each man cupped my hands in their two hands and left. They were full of respect. There was no violence. We were Osman Mahmud, not Arabs, and the Osman Mahmud very rarely hit women. But I looked out of the caravan as they walked into the blackness of the night, and I knew I had done something I could never, never undo. There was no regret, but I knew that I had cut myself off from everything that was meaningful and important to my family. So much had changed in me in the space of a few months. In Nairobi, I had been incapable of standing up for my right to refuse this man. I did tell my father I didn't want to marry him, but I felt unable to act on that. If I had, I would have been disowned, shunned, deprived of the invisible protection of the clan. My mother and sister would also, to a lesser extent, be punished. I would have been seen as prey, like Fauzia and other Somali women who are alone, begging for a roof, potentially a victim of every kind of predator. I just couldn't imagine having the strength to do it. But now I had a refugee permit. I had a right to stay in Holland, and I knew I had other rights too. Nobody could force me to go anywhere I didn't want to go. That pink piece of paper giving me refugee status had changed everything. Now I knew that. Somehow I would summon the strength to continue to defy them. Still, I felt crushed by my guilt. I couldn't sleep that night for thinking about what I was doing to my father. Early next morning, January 27, I went into my room and began writing the most difficult letter of my life. I began, "In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful," and continued, "Dearest father, after very warm greetings, I will just get to the point and tell you that I have become a disappointment to you, and I have decided to divorce Osman Musa Isa. No amount of apologies or begging for forgiveness will make you feel any better. But I will just beg you to understand, and I am very sorry. Of course I don't expect you to feel understanding towards me, but that is that. Osman telephoned you and followed your advice to bring the matter to the attention of the male relations, Tolka, and we have met and reached an agreement peacefully and honorably, if there can be anything honorable in such a situation. The agreement was that the divorce goes through. I am very sorry, Father, but that is that. I shall come back to Kenya as soon as I make enough money to pay for my ticket, and as soon as I get a visa back. Right now, I go to school. Father, I feel your unhappiness towards me, but please reply and try when your anger is over to understand me and forgive me. Maybe it's too much to ask, but I also need your blessings. Love, Ayan, your loving daughter. About a week later, I received a letter from my father postmarked January 26, the night the Tolka met. I suppose Osman had phoned him. Dear Ayan, I read, I could not believe what Osman told me about you. If it is true, you made me and our family not only mean and disgraceful, but you caused me pain and grief. I could not pray, nor could I sleep well since Osman phoned. Look, Ayan, I cannot withstand this sort of situation any longer. Therefore, either you gracefully obey your husband, or you force me to come to Holland, and I and you will decide the matter face to face. I felt lashed by his rage, by how deeply I had damaged his reputation, and I felt real fear. If he came to Holland, my father could beat me, perhaps kill me. I had shamed him, and for that I knew that he had to punish me. Then, 2 weeks after the clan gathering, I received another letter from my father. It was written on the pages of the letter I had sent him on January 27. He wrote in red ink, the color you use to write to your enemies. On the first page he wrote, as I shall not open your letters, never attempt to write. On the reverse side, across my signature, he wrote, dear deceitful fox, you do not need me, and I do not need you. I just invoked Allah to disgrace you, as you have disgraced me. Amen. This is the last message you will receive from me, as your letter was the last message I was to accept from you. Go to hell, and the devil be with you. He added in angry capital letters, may Allah punish you for your deception. Amen. Yours, the fool. My fears that my father would kill me became less acute. For him, I was now already dead. And although I was physically intact, I felt as though I had been kicked in the stomach. I was outcast. I bought a phone card and dialed the number of the Indian family who lived next door to us in Park Road. I asked them to get her where. I needed her badly. It was the first time I had spoken to her since I had left. Hawea said she had read my letter to Abe and she was proud of me. She said she was sorry for me too, and she warned me to be careful. Abe might still come after me. His fury was frightening, even to her. I told Hawea to bring Ma to the neighbor's house next week. I wanted to talk to her too, and I begged Hawea to try to persuade her not to reject me. When I heard Ma's voice, the line crackled so much that it sounded as though she was on another planet. She said, so you did what I suspected you would. Her voice froze. Do you know how I am being treated here? I said, Hawea told me. Then my mother said, you have made a terrible mistake, but you will always be my child. She went on, your father is very angry. Aren't you afraid that he's going to curse you? His curses are more effective than a mother's. I said, we shall have to see. My mother wished me good luck before we hung up. She was very kind. She promised we could speak again. Then the line went dead. I felt as though I were living through the final episode of my life. I had cast off my father, and now I had disappointed my mother too. I thought about dying and waking up in the hereafter, where you cannot hide from Allah's judgment. There was no end to my sins. I had shamed my parents, rejected a rightful husband, neglected my daily prayers. I was wearing men's clothes and had cut my hair. The book of misdeeds, written by the angel on my left shoulder, would surely weigh far more than the slim volume of my good works. My father had cursed me, and now I was damned. Chapter 12. Hawaya. For many months after receiving my father's letter, I felt very bleak. There was nothing I could do now but go forward alone in the direction that I had chosen. Slowly the weather improved, and so did my grasp of the Dutch language. The staff at the Center for Asylum Seekers began encouraging me to translate from Somali directly into Dutch instead of into English. They patiently corrected my mistakes. It was like wobbling down a road on a bicycle. I found myself getting better at it. Sylvia in particular encouraged me. She told me that I had a future. I could request that the Dutch government accept my Kenyan O levels as a high school equivalency, and then I could study, perhaps even qualify to attend the university if that was what I really wanted. One day, a Somali girl asked me to go with her to the hospital. She had to have a gynecological exam. The doctor told me to explain that this girl would have to take off her clothes and that he would look at her uterus with a long silver tool. She told me, "I will do it, but I don't think he will be able to see my uterus." I understood. She was closed up, a scar. I tried to tell the doctor, but he just retorted, "Do as I say." But when she climbed onto the table and he looked between her legs, he snapped back with shock and swore. Then he angrily ripped his gloves off, because no steel tool was getting inside that. This girl had no genitals at all, just a completely smooth panel of scar tissue between her legs. This was the Fir'auni, the excision so extreme that the woman's whole genitals are scraped off and mend into a hard band of dark skin. I had never seen one. Mostly only the Issa girls from the north are excised in this way, but I knew what it was. The doctor, though, thought the girl had been burned. The whole medical team seemed shocked. It dawned on me that here in Europe, the excision of women was unheard of. In May 1993, I received an official letter. I had housing. The municipality of Ede was able to offer me a one-room apartment. I would receive an unemployment allowance that would pay for the rent. I welcomed the prospect of leaving the refugee center. Fights constantly broke out between asylum seekers over politics or women, and there was constant gossip. But when I told Yasmin my news, she burst into tears and asked, "So you're going to leave me here?" Yasmin's claim to refugee status had been refused. But because she had declared she was a minor, she was allowed to remain in Holland. She had to live at the asylum seeker center and attend a special school for foreigners, which she hated. I asked the housing office if Yasmin could live with me, but she couldn't. It was a one-room apartment. If I wanted a two-bedroom place, I would have to wait. I thought about it. I had been so selfish. If I didn't stand by Yasmin now, I risked becoming a truly bad person. I turned the flat down and applied for a two-bedroom with Yasmin. I began making friends with some of the people who had worked at the asylum seeker center. A counselor a few years older than I, Hanneke, introduced me to her friend Ellen, who was my age and studying social work at the local Christian vocational college. We rented videos, went for walks, and arranged picnics. All sorts of girly things which I loved doing. They introduced me to their friends and their families. Both Hanneke and Ellen were Christians and seemed to take their religion seriously, but they still went to pubs. The first time Hanneke persuaded me to come along, I thought Allah truly might strike me down. It had been a long time since I last prayed, but going to a bar, this was really haram. In fact, a pub turned out to be just a place where people stood up for hours in a crowd of other people, drinking alcohol and smoking and shouting at each other over loud music. I could never understand much of what was going on. The custom was mystifying. I kept going there, however, because the others liked it. I didn't drink, but still, sometimes when I came home, I would feel bad about it. How could I be going to places like this? Places that had once seemed so evil. I would tell myself, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't seduce or encourage anyone. Just drank a Coca-Cola wearing jeans. There's nothing wrong with that. If I wasn't doing anything wrong, then surely Allah wouldn't punish me. Actually, I didn't get why people needed to go to a noisy place to talk. Ada was a nice, conservative, Protestant small town, a very peaceful, predictable place. There wasn't any bad behavior in pubs. People got drinks, and the people who were together in a group stood facing each other in a small circle and shouted at each other over the music. When they were choosing which pub to go to, people always picked the one that was already packed. There was no logic to it. I was having difficulty figuring out the Dutch. I imagined going home and telling her where, from sunrise to sunset, they seem normal, but they have some weird habits in the evenings. Hanneke thought it was important for me to see more of Holland. One spring weekend, she decided to take me to Amsterdam for the day. There we strolled around the elegant houses around the Herengracht, the gentleman's canal, with its tiny, delicate bridges. Every Dutch city, it seemed, had a center that was ancient and lovely, and such a lot of thought had been given to preserving it. You could walk undisturbed in the streets at night. It was orderly and clean. Everything seemed to function so beautifully in this country, while a few hours away there was so much conflict and filth and hardship. Hanneke also walked me through the red light district near the central station, just to show me what it was like. I remember feeling as if I'd been hit in the stomach by the sight of women standing behind glass, naked or strung together in obscenely sexual clothes. It made me think of animal parts hanging off hooks at the butcher's stall in Kariakor Market. This was exploitation. I recoiled from it. Hanneke couldn't persuade me that these women were doing it voluntarily, as an honest day's work. But this unpleasant sight of Dutch society seemed also to have no connection with the Holland I knew. Ordinary Dutch people were not depraved in this way. Perhaps I had more connection with them than most foreigners did, but I was convinced that the Dutch were not the licentious monsters that many Somali asylum seekers perceived. Ellen and I had numerous conversations about her Christian beliefs. Her relationship with God seemed to be about dialogue and love, a striking contrast to the fear and submission I had been taught to show. Ellen had been brought up a fundamentalist Protestant. Her parents were from a strict Dutch Reformed denomination. They went to church twice every Sunday and made her wear long skirts. Ellen was searching for her own way to relate to God, and this troubled her. Still, her beliefs seemed far less restrictive than Islam as I knew it. In fact, I thought they were much too pleasant and convenient to be true. Ellen said she prayed to God only when she felt like it. She said her Christian God was a kind, fatherly figure, though mystifyingly, he seemed not to help her directly. Apparently, he wanted Ellen to help herself. She told me, "In your religion, there's so much hell, and you pray because you have to. This is a master-slave relationship." Ellen had a boyfriend. She was in love with one of the Iranian asylum seekers, Badal Zadeh, but she wanted to start marriage as a virgin. She and her boyfriend used to kiss on the mouth quite openly, even in front of people. Ellen used to tell me, "But this is normal," and it was true. Young people did this all the time on the street. I had noticed it the minute I got off the plane, and all the Somalis said this was what the filthy Galo always did. And yet, Ellen still wanted to be a virgin? One day, the four of us were sitting around watching television in the apartment that Hanneke and Ellen shared in Ede. The program was called All You Need Is Love. Dutch men and women declared their love for someone in front of the whole nation, and the presenter played Cupid. After a commercial break, the viewers got to see if this love was mutual or not. It seemed completely barbaric to Yasmin and me. Ellen and I started talking about love, courtship, and virginity. To me, as a Somali, being a virgin meant being excised, physically sewn shut. I had already figured out that Dutch people didn't do that. So I asked, "How will your husband find out whether you're a virgin or not? Is there a test?" Ellen replied, "Of course not. He will know I'm a virgin because I say I am." My question seemed weird to her, so she asked, "You have a test?" I told her, "We are cut and sewn shut, so that the skin is closed, and when a man penetrates you, there is blood. There can be no pretending." Ellen and Hanneke were disgusted, appalled. They asked, "And this happened to you?" Yasmin and I both said yes. And Yasmin, who was a snob, added, "If you are not cut, you are not pure, are you?" Very innocently, with her big blue eyes wide, Ellen asked, "Pure from what?" Pure from what? Pure from what exactly? I thought about it for a long time and realized I had no answer. It wasn't completely because of Islam that we are cut. Not all Muslim women are excised. But in Somalia and the other Muslim countries, it was clear that the Islamic culture of virginity encouraged it. I knew of no fatwa denouncing female genital mutilation. On the contrary, suppressing the sexuality of women was a big theme with imams. Boqol Soum and the other ma'alims had always preached endlessly about how women should become aware of their sexual powers. They must cover themselves and stay indoors. They went into minute detail about this, yet somehow they never got around to saying that it is wrong to cut girls and sew them up. What were we being kept pure from? Somebody owned us? What was between my legs was not mine to give. I was branded. I found I had no answer for Ellen. I just gaped at her and said, "It's our tradition." And because Ellen truly was a believer, she said, "But you believe God created you, don't you?" I said, "Yes, of course." Ellen said, "So the way God made us is the way God wants us to be. Why shouldn't we stay like that? Why does your culture feel we should improve on God's work? Isn't that blasphemy?" I stared at her. There really seemed to be something to what Ellen was saying. Ellen said Dutch women were never circumcised, and neither were Dutch men. Yasmin curled up her face in disgust at that. The minute we left, Yasmin started rubbing her skin. When she got home, she washed for hours. "I sat in their house and ate off their plates, and they are not purified," Yasmin said. "She's filthy. This whole country is filthy." I thought about it. Ellen wasn't filthy. And neither was Holland. In fact, it was a lot cleaner than Somalia or anywhere else I had lived. I couldn't understand how Yasmin could perceive Holland as evil, even though all around us were Dutch people treating us with kindness and hospitality. I was beginning to see that the Dutch value system was more consistent, more honest, and gave more people more happiness than the one with which we had been brought up. Unfortunately, many of these Dutch ideas seemed not to be congruent with Islam. I replied, "Yasmin, you know what? You better get used to it, because your teacher in school is not circumcised. The person cooking your lunch is not circumcised. If you want to remain completely pure here, you will have to lock yourself away and never have any contact with a white person." But Yasmin said, "There is a difference, and that is why the Quran tells us never to make unbelievers our friends." In July 1993, I finally was allotted a two-room apartment in Ede. It cost 600 guilders a month, but I would receive a 5,000 guilder loan for furniture, which I would have to pay back, and a monthly unemployment allowance of 1,200 guilders. Yasmin, who the Dutch believed to be only 15, would be released into my guardianship. The flat was in James Wattstraat, a neighborhood of low-rise brick buildings, maybe a little shabby, but not squalid by any means. I thought it was nice, but in the building next door to ours, a Turkish woman was beaten almost every night. We had all of it. We had her smashing against the wall of a living room and crying for mercy. Ellen and Hanneke told us we should call the police. We did. But the police phoned us back, very politely, to say there was nothing they could do. They had visited the apartment, and the woman in question hadn't filed a complaint. The next night, she was screaming again. Her husband used to turn the television up loud so people couldn't hear her. I saw this woman in the street very rarely. She almost never left the house. I think what she felt was shame. The whole neighborhood knew about her. She cringed and scuttled. One day, the refugee officer from the asylum seeker center came to check on our progress. He said to me, "Ayan, how is it possible that your Dutch has become worse since you left us?" Ever since I had moved to town, I had almost stopped speaking Dutch. I spoke Somali with Yasmin and English with Ellen and Hanek. I understood simple Dutch, but it didn't yet come out of my mouth right. It embarrassed me. The refugee officer offered to put a notice up in his church to find someone who would agree to give us a free hour of conversation in Dutch every week. That was how, about a year after I arrived in Holland, I met Johanna. Johanna became like a mother to me as I gradually began to adapt to this strange but pleasant country. Yasmin and I went to Johanna's house once a week, then twice, then as often as we felt like it. We would just drop by as if we were in Somalia. We cooked in her kitchen and played with her children. Johanna taught us so much more than language. She taught us how to live in the West. There were the little things. How to be economical. Look for the cheaper items on the lower shelves at the supermarket. Turn down the heat and wear a sweater indoors. How to navigate through society. In Holland, you open a present in front of the giver. And even if you are a woman, you must look people straight in the eye. Johanna taught us other important things too. She told us to speak to people directly. Not pussyfoot around, just to get to the point. If you had no money, you admitted it, then you looked at why you had overspent. There was no honor, no shame, no complex preamble. You admitted the problem clearly, and you learned your lesson. She taught us to be self-reliant and to deal with problems squarely. All my life, I had watched my mother veer off and pretend problems weren't there, hoping Allah would just make them disappear on their own. But Johanna faced these things. She said what she wanted. She was clear and direct instead of avoiding issues that were difficult. She would tell us, "There's nothing rude about saying no." Johanna's house was modern, a grey brick home with a carefully tended garden. It was small but put together so that everything fit. The gadgets were fascinating. There was a special spoke in the garden that fanned out when you needed to dry the laundry and folded up when you didn't need it. Even the cheese slicer seemed ingenious. Johanna's husband, Martin, was not the boss of the household. The two of them talked things over together. They asked each other's advice. The children were allowed to interrupt them too, and Martin and Johanna listened to their opinions. And Martin helped with the housework. The kids went to bed every night at 8 and not a minute later. It was a very structured life, and a lot of thought had gone into building that structure. Johanna was always consulting books on child development, and though she punished her children if they misbehaved, I don't think she ever hit them. Her family was very like the whole country, so well kept, so well planned, so smoothly run and attractive. It seemed nothing could go unnoticed in such a place. Sometimes that felt constricting, but it also seemed welcoming and safe. It was a much more attractive model than any family I had seen in the world I came from. And most important, this family was warm to me. They took me in. Johanna was wise and skeptical, with a dry sense of humor and enormous capacity for openness and love. I began looking on her as a confidant, a guide. I told Johanna how selfish I felt about what I had done to my parents. But Johanna didn't think there was anything wrong with putting myself first. She said it wasn't selfish to do what you wanted with your life. Everyone should pursue her own happiness. She said I had done the right thing and made me feel that I might still be a good person. Every Islamic value I had been taught instructed me to put myself last. Life on earth is a test, and if you manage to put yourself last in this life, you're serving Allah. Your place will be first in the hereafter. The more deeply you submit your will, the more virtuous that makes you. But Johanna, Ellen, and everyone else in Holland seemed to think that it was natural to seek one's own personal happiness on earth, in the here and now. After Yasmin and I moved to our apartment in Ada, I resolved that I would go out to work. Being on welfare shamed me. Sylvia and the other workers at the center had taken the time to answer my incessant questions, and I now understood roughly what a welfare state was. The able contributing to help the needy. I was able. I had arms and legs. I didn't want to keep taking and never give. I went first to the Government Employment Bureau. The woman there registered me, but she said there wouldn't be much point in my working. I wanted to keep on with my Dutch classes, and whatever I earned in sporadic temporary jobs would be subtracted from my welfare payment. I would be allowed to keep only the surplus if there was one. I decided that I must try to work anyway, and that afternoon I registered with all the temp agencies in town. I said I was qualified as a secretary and wanted a job. My Dutch was completely inadequate, but the agency staff put my name in their data banks. 2 days later, a woman called from Tempo Team. The Riedel orange juice factory in Ede needed a temporary cleaner. I was supposed to clean the factory from 6 to 8 in the morning before the workers' shift started. The factory floor, the canteen, the toilets. It wasn't nice, but it wasn't difficult. Another job I did was packing huge rolls of thread into a flat box at a dye manufacturer, Akzo Nobel. The boxes were taped shut by the next worker down the assembly line. In another similar position at a biscuit factory de Lacre, I packed cookies into plastic containers. I did these two jobs several times, replacing people who were ill or on holiday for a few weeks. I also did a number of stints, putting letters into envelopes at the housing corporation. There was nothing noble about these jobs, but they weren't dishonorable either. They were mundane, but they paid money, and they were convenient. If I took the morning shifts, I could attend Dutch class in the late afternoon. I saw them as stepping stones. If I worked enough, I could earn more than my welfare benefit, and the surplus helped pay for my rent and classes. Working at factories gave me a chance to see another social class of Dutch people. So far, I had met only social workers and middle-class people who volunteered at the refugee camp. Working-class people spoke differently, and their interaction with migrants was not as easygoing. At the biscuit factory, almost all the workers were women, and they divided clearly into ethnic groups. Dutch women on the one hand and Moroccan and Turkish women on the other. They kept apart in the lunchroom and on the factory floor as well. If a Moroccan woman was paired with a native Dutch woman, the work would be done shoddily and there would be constant conflict with packages piling up and falling on the floor, whereas if Moroccans worked together, they made an effort to get the job done right. It was mutual xenophobia. The Dutch thought the Moroccans were lazy and unpleasant, and the Moroccans said the Dutch stunk and dressed like whores. Both groups saw themselves as superior. The dye factory was almost all Dutch. Some of the workers had been employed there for 10, even 20 years. They liked their jobs, they told me, and I saw that they expected to work hard and get it done efficiently. And there was a kind of pleasure in doing even a lowly job well. Gradually, I was changing, learning how to adapt to this new country, to manage time and work and go to school alone. 6 months after I registered at the government labor agency, they called me in to take an IQ test. The test was very long, and I'm sure it was extremely expensive. A lot of it was math, which I have always been hopeless at. The rest of it was psychological tests and language skills. Dutch language, of course. My results were poor. The job counselor told me I was eligible to attend a medium-level vocational course, something administrative, like bookkeeping or training to be a receptionist. Something with very little theory, which would swiftly prepare me to work. I told her that I wanted to study political science, and she said I couldn't. Political science was a university course, and I could never hope to get in. The job counselor sent me to learn bookkeeping in Wageningen, a village close to Ede. That was a very expensive course too, but it seemed to her to be the only option. I suppose she thought that the universal language of numbers would be easier for a foreigner to grasp. I did horribly. After 4 weeks, my debit side had never once matched my credit side. The teacher sighed and said, "This is really not for you." I said, "I told them that." So he wrote a letter saying I was not suitable for bookkeeping, and I stopped attending class. I still wanted more than this life. I had decided I wanted to study political science. If that required going to university, then that's where I would go. Ellen and Hanneke thought I was mad. A degree, sure, that was a fine ambition, but in political science? I tried to explain that I wanted to understand why life in Holland was so different from life in Africa. Why there was so much peace, security, and wealth in Europe. What the causes of war were, and how you built peace. I didn't have any answers, just questions. I thought about it all the time. Every contact I had with government, I thought, how do you get to have a government like this? I watched Hanneke and Ellen draw up schedules with the other girls they shared their flat with. Lists of who would do the cleaning and the grocery shopping and cooking. And it was like the bus timetable. All the girls actually did all the chores. Amazingly, there wasn't even any conflict about it. How would you get to be this way? There were rules about everything in Holland. I got stopped by a policeman one evening for cycling without my lights on, and I froze, assuming something horrible was going to happen. But all I got was a firm but courteous lecture and a fine of 25 guilders. Moreover, the policeman said I wasn't supposed to pay the fine right away. It would come in the mail. Sure enough, a month later, I received a detailed bill. I thought about this system, how cleverly it prevented you ever giving a policeman money, so he never got tempted to pocket it. Government was very present in this country. It could be bureaucratic, sometimes stupidly complex. But it also seemed very beneficial. I wanted to know how you do that. This was an infidel country, whose way of life we Muslims were supposed to oppose and reject. Why was it then so much better run, better led, and made for such better lives than the places we came from? Shouldn't the places where Allah was worshipped and his laws obeyed have been at peace and wealthy, and the unbeliever countries ignorant, poor, and at war? I wanted to understand conflict. In 1992 and 1993, it seemed as if the whole world outside the West was breaking out in civil wars and tribal conflicts. The end of the Cold War had unfrozen old fault lines of hatred. And of all the countries where war had broken out, so many seemed to be Muslim. What was wrong with us? Why should infidels have peace and Muslims be killing each other when we were the ones who worshipped the true God? If I studied political science, I thought, I would understand that. It wasn't going to be easy to qualify. The government had accepted my O-levels and Kenyan secretarial course as equivalent to a Harvard Plus school diploma, but even this was stretching it. To get into the university, I would need another qualification called a propedeuse. I panicked. I thought I could never pass the math. With Ellen's help, I figured out that the easiest way for me to pass the propedeuse would be to study social work in a vocational college, as Ellen and Hanneke did. That way, after a year, I could transfer to the university and I could avoid encountering too much math. I announced to my language school that I wanted to register for the Dutch language test that I would need to pass in order to attend the vocational college. My teacher was kind, but told me condescendingly that it was far too early. I had been studying Dutch for only a year. People took 3 years. I was being impatient and irresponsible. It would be a waste of my money even to apply. Ellen told me the teacher had no right to prevent me. It was my money. So I went to the exam center in Nijmegen and registered to take the Dutch test anyway. And I passed. Vocational college would be my next step. All this time, I had mostly avoided other Somalis. Even when we were still living in the asylum seeker center, I hadn't had much fun with them. Everyone who hung out in Hassana's caravan seemed to spend all their time complaining, especially the people who lived outside the asylum center, who had been in Holland for years and was simply visiting. These Somalis weren't integrating into Dutch society. They weren't working. They had nothing to do but hang about the asylum seeker and catch meals. There were a few individuals who learned to cycle, who were ambitious, and studied and worked. I wasn't unique, but those people had no time to socialize. The others just chewed qaad all night and sat around talking about how horrible Holland was. We were all facing the same confusion. We had always been sure that we, as Muslims and Somalis, were superior to unbelievers, and here we were not superior at all. In day-to-day life, we didn't know how the cash machines worked, or that you had to push a button to order the bus to stop. One time I took a bus together with Dahabo, another Somali asylum seeker. When it hurtled right on past where we wanted to go, Dahabo yelled, "Stop!" and everyone stared at us. It was embarrassing. Many people withdrew from such embarrassment into an enclave of shared Somaliness. Their reaction was to create a fantasy that they, as Somalis, knew better about everything than these inferior white people. "You don't need to teach me how to use a thermometer. Our Somali thermometers are much more advanced." That kind of attitude. "His breath smells of pig. He's only a bus driver. How dare he think he can tell me how to behave?" In my first weeks at the asylum center, as I was standing in a crowd of Somalis just outside Hasna's caravan, someone called to us, "There's a man crying on TV." We rushed to the television. It was a program called I Am Sorry, where people confessed things. A huge, broad-shouldered Dutch man, red-faced and squeaky-voiced, was weeping. Weeping tears over something he had done. He whimpered, "I'm so sorry." And we stared at each other in horror and wonder. I'm sure none of us had ever seen a man cry. Then we burst out laughing. This country was so strange to us. By the time I moved to Ede, I had come to understand Holland better. It irritated me now when Somalis who had lived in Holland for a long time complained that they were offered only lowly jobs. They wanted honorable professions. Airline pilot, lawyer. When I pointed out that they had no qualifications for such work, their attitude was that everything was Holland's fault. The Europeans had colonized Somalia, which was why we all had no qualifications and were in this mess to begin with. I thought that was so clearly nonsense. We had torn ourselves apart, all on our own. It was the same sort of defensive, arrogant attitude that I had often seen among people from rural areas who emigrated to the city, whether Mogadishu or Nairobi. Here in Holland, the claim was always that we were held back by racism. Everyone seemed to be in a constant simmer of anger about how we were discriminated against because we were black. If a shopkeeper wouldn't bargain over the price of a t-shirt, Yasmin said there were special discount prices only for white people. She and Hasna told me they often didn't bother paying for buses. They just invented appointments in town, and if the refugee office didn't give them a ticket, they said they were being racist. If you tell a Dutch person it's racist, he'll give you whatever you want, Hasna once told me with satisfaction. There is discrimination in Holland. I would never deny that. But the claim of racism can also be strategic. Sometimes it did feel good to be around Somalis, to relax with people I completely understood. Adapting to Dutch people was still a huge effort for me. But the minute I said, "I'm sorry, tomorrow morning I have to wake up early," the Somalis were at me. I was acting white. Who did I think I was? I looked down on them. I had become galo. Somali young men constantly approached me on the street as if they had some kind of right to me. They made obscene suggestions. To them, I was obviously immoral and therefore available. Somali women always tried to wheedle money out of me. I didn't give it to them. I used to say, why should I? I thought if they needed more money, they could do factory work too. I felt embarrassed and even let down by the way so many Somalis accepted welfare money and then turned on the society that gave it to them. There was still a lot of clan feeling in me. I felt somehow responsible for their actions. I didn't like how they denied misdeeds, even if they were caught red-handed. I didn't like how they boasted or the myths and transparently false conspiracy theories they propagated. I didn't like the endless gossiping or the constant complaints that they were victims of external factors. Somalis never said sorry, or I made a mistake, or I don't know. They invented excuses. All these group strategies to avoid confronting reality depressed me. Reality is not easy, but all this make-believe doesn't make it easier. So I spent my time with Ellen and Hanukkah. But that left Yasmin all alone after school ended, which was at about 3 every day. A bunch of Isaac and Hawiya boys from the asylum center began coming to our apartment in the afternoons to chew qat. Somalis are extremely good at getting things done when they want to. And somehow, there were fresh qat leaves available even in Little Ada. Yasmin used to cook for these men, so when I came home, they would all be reclining on a mat in the living room with the leaves and stalks on the floor. For a while, I crept around in my own house, feeling invaded. Among Somalis, it is dishonorable to turn a guest out of your house. Finally, though, I did it the Dutch way. I told Yasmin to stop it. I didn't want these men in my place. I told Yasmin that when they rang the doorbell, we would pretend to be out. After that, on the street, I got a name as the awful Darod woman who was snooty to the Isaac and the Hawiya, and that was fine by me. I didn't want to observe the code of honor anymore. The relationship between Yasmin and me began deteriorating. One night she walked out. I didn't even realize she was gone till 2 days later, not until I found out that my bank card and my A-status refugee papers were missing. She had just given me 300 guilders for the month's rent, and that was gone too. A few days later, I got a letter from her. She said she was in Italy, but the letter was postmarked Denmark. She said she was sorry and she hadn't used the bank card. The 300 guilders wasn't really stealing because it was hers. She said she was lonely and hated living in Holland. She said the phone bill might be high, but she had needed her family. About a month later, I received a 2,500 guilder phone bill and went berserk. I was beyond bankrupt. Johanna helped me call the phone company. They sent a detailed bill, and it was Australia, Canada, Kenya, Somalia. I had no idea Yasmin knew so many people. Johanna said, take Yasmin's letter to her social worker, because it proves that she made all these calls, and they will look after the bill. I did, and Yasmin's social work agency paid about 2,000 guilders. One morning in January 1994, the phone rang. It was Hawiya. She was standing in a phone booth at the Frankfurt airport. It had been months since I had last called home. Now my sister was here, in Europe. She had just arrived. A huge wave of joy rushed over me. I asked Hawiya if this was just a visit or more, and she said, more. I said, come to Holland. Come and live with me. I called my friends Jan and Greetje. Jan was in his late 50s and a volunteer at Refugee Aid. He suggested that Hawiya take a train to the German border. He would meet her there and drive her into Holland by car to avoid any checkpoints. That way, Hawiya could claim she had travelled directly to Holland. It meant she could ask for asylum in Holland instead of in Germany. When Jan's car finally drove up with Hawiya inside, we hugged and screamed and jumped and laughed and hugged again. But after a while, Hawiya slumped into a chair and started crying. Finally, she told me she had had an abortion in Nairobi. A man who was from Trinidad, who worked for the United Nations, who was divorced. She had loved this man, and she had become pregnant. A man from Trinidad, uncircumcised, not even a Muslim, flat-nosed, round-faced, kinky-haired. My mother would have seen such a man as subhuman like the Kenyans. What Hawiya had done was, in clan terms, unforgivable. Running away from your husband was one thing, but getting pregnant out of wedlock, and with such a person. It was as if the whole Osman Mahmoud family had been impregnated by somebody from Trinidad. Hawiya's lover arranged for her to have an abortion, discreetly, with an Indian doctor. Afterward, when she felt so rocky, he said, take time off, go to Holland, see your sister. I choked back the Somali in me, which was appalled by the whole story. I told her to stop crying. I said these weren't the right circumstances to have a child. Be sensible. Don't torture yourself. I said the sort of things Johanna would say, and then I put Hawea to bed in Yasmin's old room, just as Johanna would have done. But Hawea didn't spring back to life. She was dreamy, absent-minded, unfocused. She couldn't sleep. She said the fights at home with Ma had gotten completely out of hand. She had come to me with no plan, no idea of what to do next. I was so eager to have my sister live with me. I helped her cook up a story that would get her refugee status. Hawea registered as an asylum seeker in Lintren, and the refugee center agreed to allow her to stay with me as long as she signed in once a week. Hawea started Dutch lessons, but it was just one lesson every week at the refugee center with a volunteer, because she wasn't allowed to take proper classes until she was given refugee papers. I took her out with me and my friends. We took long walks together and watched all the films we wanted to without fear of punishment. We took trips to Amsterdam. I taught her to cycle. We had many happy moments. But so often, Hawea didn't seem to want to be anywhere. She spent most of the time lying on the sofa, watching TV until the programs turned to snow. She had bouts of crying. Tears simply rolled down her cheeks. She tramped off on long walks on her own. We called Ma from time to time, always using her Indian neighbor's phone. Our conversations were predictable. Ma would always tell us to pray, to fast, to read the Quran, or she would complain. She constantly told me she had sacrificed her whole life for her children, and all of us had let her down. Her legs were covered with open sores from her psoriasis. Her head hurt. We had left her to die like this. It was our fault. Mahat didn't look after her and never held down a job. He thought he was too good for anything he was qualified to do. Calling Ma was not always pleasant, but I did it and I sent money because it was my duty. The months went by. Hawea began spending much more time at the asylum seeker, seeking companionship. I found out she was having a relationship with a Somali boy there, and I suspected that they were sleeping together. One day, Hawea told me she was pregnant again. Here, I had cut almost all ties with Somalia, and my sister was reviving them. I got really angry with her. I hate to think about it now. I yelled, "Is this going to be a habit? To get pregnant once may be forgivable, but now you're in Holland. Condoms are free at the refugee center," I told Hawea. "You can't have another abortion. This is murder. You'll have the baby, and I'll look after it." I moralized. Hawea insisted she wanted an abortion anyway. We had a huge fight. I went with her to the refugee center to ask for medical assistance. I asked the social work counselor, Jose, to talk to Hawea because I was worried about her. To my surprise, Jose said Hawea had already approached her. She said, "There are deep problems, but don't worry about your sister. I see her every week, and I believe it's helping." I had no idea that Hawea was in any kind of psychotherapy. Jose said this was because Hawea was afraid of my judgment. So Hawea had the abortion, and after she received her refugee status, she began attending proper language school. Something brightened about her for a while. My little sister's sparky quick wit began flashing through again. She could be charming, sharp, funny, stylish. But then she would slump again and stop looking after her clothes and her hair. Or she would turn on people. She could be very aggressive. She still wasn't sleeping well. I couldn't register for the same course in social work as Ellen and Hanukkah, although their college was in Ede. It was a Christian school. You had to acknowledge the existence of the Trinity to attend classes there. For me at the time, that was absolute blasphemy. To associate Allah with other unities and say he had a child, you would burn in hell for saying this. Allah is not begotten, nor does he beget. It was out of the question that I attend such a place. I wanted to apply to a secular vocational college in Arnhem, but an official at Refugee Aid told me I wouldn't be happy there. I should go to Driebergen, which was also a secular college, but much more multicultural, a code word for ethnically mixed. Again, the advice was well-meaning, but it was based on preconceived notions about where I, as an immigrant, would feel comfortable. And of course, such advice only reinforced the immigrant's urge to build enclaves. When I went to Driebergen to apply, the administrator told me I would have to pass an admissions exam. There would be papers in Dutch, history, and civics. Reeling, I asked, where are the books to study for them? The administrator said they had a class that helped students prepare for the exam. This pre-exam class lasted for 4 months. I could start in February 1994 and take the exam in June. I went back to the Government Labour Bureau and said I had found what I wanted to do. As I had dropped bookkeeping, could they now kindly pay for this pre-college course in Dutch history? But the Labour Bureau refused. They couldn't finance something that wasn't authorized by the IQ test I had taken. They said I would have to apply for a student grant, which I wouldn't be eligible for until I was actually admitted to the college itself. So I paid for the preparation on my own. It was nothing like school in Kenya. We sat in a circle and called the teacher by his first name. There was no "Good morning, Mrs. Nyere" in unison and no uniform. If you failed the exams, you got a second chance, which seemed a little foolish, but still kind. And it was only 300 guilders. For this, I didn't mind scrimping. The most fascinating class was history. Every week, we discussed a chapter in the textbook, which covered not just Holland, but the history of the modern world. Each country had a chapter, and I read every word of all of them. There was Germany, how it became a state, then the Weimar Republic, the rise of Hitler, the Second World War, the Russian Revolution, Tsars, Bolsheviks, Stalin, the American Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War. Each country had a life. It struggled and took form. Systems rose and fell. It was like a story. The book told a very romantic, optimistic view of modern history. There was a chapter on colonization and decolonization, which ended with prospects for a bright future for Africa. There was the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, which brought an end to communism. There was the story of the United Nations. I was completely absorbed. I realized this text was just an overview to give us a grip on what happened where. I wanted more. I wanted to study further why so many of the decolonized countries had fallen apart and why the countries that I had lived in weren't working. That history book taught me Dutch. The civics class, on the other hand, was full of terms I didn't understand, like municipality and upper chamber. I scraped through it. I failed the Dutch class by just 1 point. I still couldn't write proper grammar, but because I had my Dutch equivalency exam, they let me enroll in Driebergen Vocational College anyway. By the skin of my teeth, I had made it. I could start attending college in Driebergen in September. I applied for and received a student loan. Then, at the end of August, I was called to an introductory weekend. The other girls, they were mostly girls in the social work course, were friendly and open, but they were much younger than I. At 24 years old, I was gawky, wore ill-fitting clothes, and cut my hair really short like a boy's. I liked it that way. Looking after long hair, braiding and oiling it was so difficult to do in Holland. Dutch hairdressers couldn't understand my hair. With it shorn, I felt free of all the bother and much more. I couldn't feel anyone's eyes boring into me. With no headscarf, with short hair and jeans, I was nobody's thing. No Somalis attended the vocational college, so nobody felt he could tell me what to do. There were a few Moroccans and Turks, but I was not their responsibility. I felt under intense pressure. I really had to prove to myself that I could make it. Social work didn't appeal to me that much in itself. For me, it was the simplest way to get into political science. But I was unexpectedly thrilled by the course in psychology. The idea of taking some distance from yourself, of thinking in a systematic way about who you are and how the mind is built up, gave me a whole new way of looking at life. Meeting Freud put me in contact with an alternative moral system. In Nairobi, I had had plenty of contact with Christianity and had heard of Buddhists and Hindus, but I didn't for one instant imagine that a moral framework for humanity could exist that wasn't religious. There was always a God. Not having one was immoral. If you didn't accept God, then you couldn't have a morality. This is why the words infidel and apostate are so hideous to a Muslim. They are synonymous with immorality in the deepest way. But here was psychology, a story with no religious roots. It was about drives, the passion to eat, have sex, excrete, kill, and how you master those drives by learning to understand them. When I read the first week's assignment, I thought, are they trying to make people become unbelievers? But the material was fascinating. I recognized so much of myself and my family in it. I learned about Rogers and Skinner and Pavlov and reveled in these theories about what makes human individuals tick. I also found clear explanations of sexuality, which had tortured me so much as an adolescent. Gradually, I began to see that the way I had been brought up didn't work. Excisions of my genitals didn't eliminate the human sex drive, and neither did the fear of hellfire. Repression only led to hypocrisy and lying, strategies that corrupt the human individual, and it failed to protect people from unwanted pregnancy and disease. The Dutch apparently did things differently. They explained puberty to their children and told them that sexual feelings would come along with the physical changes. Dutch teenagers were apparently expected to experiment with their sexual feelings, but they did so using their reason with more information than I had ever dreamed was available. I also took a class in child development, which was again entirely new to me. I wondered how I could be even vaguely balanced when my parents had paid attention to none of this. The cognitive development, the emotional security, the motor skills, the social skills, all of which were supposed to be vital to creating a well-formed human being. I read that bullying could destroy a child's self-confidence, making him withdrawn and antisocial, and remembered how pitilessly Hawea was bullied in primary school. It didn't occur to me at the time to think of excision as a kind of a trauma, but I thought about the way Ma beat us. I didn't want to judge my mother. I love her. Everyone I knew in Nairobi hit their kids. But to discipline us, without ever explaining anything, according to the books, this was damaging and wrong. I made friends with Naima, a Moroccan girl in my class who cycled to Ada station every morning and rode the same train as I to Driebergen. Naima was my age, and with her I felt something of the easy familiarity of being among the Somalis, with none of the sharpness of their disapproval. We cooked for each other, and her food was very much like mine. During Ramadan, both of us fasted. With Naima, there was none of the punctuality you had to observe with Dutch people, which was a relief too. Naima was married. She had come to Holland as a child and had lived here all her life. She didn't wear a headscarf, but was active in a Moroccan women's group at her local community center, and they danced and ate together. When she took me there, it reminded me of being with Halwa and her sisters. Naima came in one morning with a black eye. I asked, "What happened to you?" She said her husband beat her. She was totally matter-of-fact about it. Over the next few weeks, she got beaten again and again. I told her she was mad to let him do it. I told her she could leave her husband. In this country, she could file for divorce. But Naima knew that I understood why she couldn't do it. Her husband was from her father's village. She had not met him before they were betrothed. That was how she had always lived. Even in Holland, where it was easily possible, Naima felt she simply couldn't just break away. Leaving her husband would mean leaving her family. It would shame them and leave her homeless. Where could she go? Where could she hide? I had managed to disappear in Holland, but Naima's family lived here. They would find her. Naima complained constantly, but it was about the Dutch. She was always insisting that shopkeepers looked askance at her because they were racist and they didn't want Moroccans in their shop. Personally, I thought they were staring at her bruises and told her so. They never looked strangely at me, and I was far darker than Naima. She said it was different for me because I was a refugee, and Dutch people thought refugees were romantic. I thought this was illogical. How could anyone tell that I was a refugee? But in the train, when the conductor came to check our student transport cards, Naima would fume that he had stared at her card longer than at the white girls. She never complained about the violence.